Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as he does every Thursday for Open Mic is Alex Beam. And as Marjorie and I do every morning that he's going to be here, we marvel. We marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex Beam. Because when Alex writes, I think you'd agree, Marjorie, he's like a gymnast on a balance beam. For all his precarious linguistic flips and twists, I'm not done, he always lands on his feet, scoring a perfect 10 or close. Hello, Alex. How are
Jim,
you?
Jim, that's really friendly of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very friendly.
Yeah, that's
really
very
well
nice.
Done.
Okay. Are we starting here with a little sound, Jim? Didn't you tell me
No, we're not. We're going to get to that in a little while.
Oh, we're going to get to that in a little while. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's start with a question here. We're going to talk about this Mozart thing that you absolutely adore, Mozart. We're going to talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
But while you absolutely adore him, you apparently have utter contempt for this Errol Morris, the filmmaker,
who many people just adore,
who made this new film about Rumsfeld called The Known Unknown, very famous for the Robert McNamara film, The Fog of War, Thin Blue Line. You totally trash him in this morning's Globe. You just trash him.
And by the way, before you respond, he will be in studio with us on the 28th with us. So anything you say, we will be playing for him on the 28th.
Yes.
So go right ahead, Alex.
Really?
We'd like him to still come on the 28th as well.
You know? What's he coming in for? Are you going to give more public radio publicity to his ridiculous movie?
Some of us are actually fans of his work. What's your problem with Errol Morris, Alex?
You know, my real problem is I've just never, ever read anything negative about him. It's like an ocean of all his pals just fawning over him so that he gets, you know what he has? He has utter license. He has utter license to say almost anything he wants to say, even if it's totally devoid of content. Now, the problem is so I felt this piece had to be a counterweight to this horrible, overbearing presence of Errol Morris
now,
love.
You have complained, Alex Beam, of the Boston Globe that he gets unlimited acreage, is how you phrased it in the New York Times. I thought perhaps that might have been a little bit of jealousy going on there. You do not have unlimited acreage in the New York Times?
You think the fact that I have only 18 square feet in a small regional newspaper might prompt me to be envious
of his mega
development?
Yes, one wonders about that.
That's a fair question. Although he has written some really silly stuff, because, of course, it's the internet, so you can go on as long as you want.
Correct.
Four parts of rubbish about the known and unknown. His stuff on the Kennedy assassination is a complete disgrace. I invite readers to look at it. However, there's a however here. In my monumental work of unfairness towards Errol Morris, I did, in fact, have to deep six his really interesting and provocative work with Jim's close personal friend Harvey Silverglade on the Dr. Jeffrey McDonald case.
He is everybody's friend, Harvey Silverglade.
What did he do in the Dr. Jeffrey McDonald case?
And
tell the story, please.
Well, it's on the New York Times website, and it's an interesting story because Morris actually couldn't get funding to do this movie he wanted to do. Jeffrey McDonald, of course, is the Green Beret who was killed of murdering his wife and family. And Joe McGinnis got really, really rich off of writing this book. In any case, Morris and Silverglade, but Morris, to be fair, took the other side of this case. And he's made a really convincing argument that McDonald is unfairly incarcerated. And he really turned my thinking around on this. Because like the people who refused to give him money to do this movie, I kind of assumed that Jeffrey McDonald was guilty. Morris has written this apparently impossible to read 700-page book that literally no one is ever going to read. But he makes a convincing case.
Okay, before I move off this, well,
I'm not, well,
Jeffrey
I'm not
McDonald,
you have to jump in here and defend your pal,
I'm dying
right?
to know, though, if Jeffrey McDonald
the 28th,
did not kill
don't miss Errol Morris.
His wife and children, then who did? It was the invading hippies, as he claimed in his defense?
That was the claim, and, I hate, it's so sad that, with McGinnis's body fresh in the grave, it seems that McGinnis, even maybe intentionally, reported this story wrongly. But yes, the cover story was, Manson-like, because the Manson murders had just taken place.
Yes.
The cover story was...
And McDonald was injured himself.
Crazy acid
fuel. And McGinnis just died, by the way, but that, of course, has nothing to do with anything. Now, a couple of things come to mind before we leave this column that you wrote this morning in the Boston Globe. One, you choose to orally praise the work of Errol Morris, but couldn't find space in your 800 words
to share
the same praise. What does that say about you?
You know what the incredibly important question
Where
is?
Where is it?
is that Steve Wynn and Mohegan Sun are dueling it out in the pages of the Boston Globe. So we're not writing 800 words anymore.
Well, what are you down to?
600. So naturally, those 200 words would have been devoted to hearing Errol's side of the story.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you something
else. 400, so I don't feel so bad for you.
400.
What do you?
I haven't started clearing my throat in 400.
One of the things I actually like about your writing, if I may say something here, is you are somebody who is not afraid to, let's say, criticize somebody who's in our community. You do it fairly regularly. I mean, you do it, I would say, to excess, but that's another issue.
I've gotten really
a lot nicer. Do you worry, when you're writing a piece like this about a figure who's borderline iconic in this community, I'm serious about this. When you say, I think I'm going to write this piece, this is the idea I have, you start writing, do you ever say to yourself, maybe this is not such a good idea? Even if you believe every word, is there any trepidation about blowback?
Look, it's a serious question, but because, of course, many of my closest friends are friends of Errol Morris's. And I sort of test drove this idea. All of them said it was a bad idea. So, I mean, but I just, I was really just reacting to the fact that I had never heard a word of substantive negative commentary about him. I mean, he's done a lot. There's a lot of good things to say. But, and with the Globe, you know, you've got to be pretty careful. Like, I couldn't refer to him as, you know, congenitally overweight Cambridge filmmaker. Oh,
We'll play that on the 20th.
Yeah. You know what?
Right. That relates.
Hold on. It takes incredible. Jim wouldn't know this because he doesn't write a column.
Yeah.
Well,
actually, I do write a monthly
column
for the
Globe. But no one reads
that, Jim, with all due respect. And your mom has read it. Okay,
no, she's not around, but thank you.
Okay, fine. I'm sure your kids think it's wonderful.
He's not yet written an attack column, and it takes some courage to write an attack column.
That's why I was praising him.
So I find that very courageous.
By the way, and I should say, not only can you attack people, do you know Errol Morris at all?
No.
Okay,
no,
fine.
No, no.
You have attacked, as you know, not quite in a column, and I haven't brought this up in months. You chose to attack two people who I would say some would consider your friend. That would be us.
Years and years. That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
You were getting big bucks on commercial radio. I could say what I wanted.
Did you say to yourself at the time that that was an inappropriate thing for you to do for two people you have a relative amount of respect for? Well, how about that? I both like and respect you.
Okay, no,
fine.
No.
He trashed us in
if
the
it's true, look, truth is a defense. If you guys had stepped in something, as you so often do,
yes,
it was not at all, you know, inopportune of me.
Okay, here's an email from Art who says
we don't want to hear from
who says Art is one that Alex is wonderful, excellent columnist, really funny. Love today's column, especially after the saccharine fawning piece on the Morris movie in the Globe the other day. And why do I get the feeling Jim's opinion would change instantly if Morris was going after someone from the left?
Okay, fine. Now let's
which
talk
will
about
never happen, by the way.
Now somebody who you apparently feel quite warmly about is long dead. Someone you wrote about the other day. I actually found this piece fairly interesting. What was your whole take on the Mozart phenomenon? Well, you're making a face at me like you haven't read your own piece. You don't remember
so
what you wrote?
Ago. No, well, but the piece wasn't actually about Mozart. But
I understand. Tell people what it was about.
Okay.
Well, extraordinary. Go ahead.
Right,
you
right.
tell.
I don't know. It's a set piece. You know, I put it. It's in my list of 50 pieces to do. And okay, the point is. If you're a composer, say, like Billy Joel, who spoke about this to the New York Times, if you want to be in music, how can you handle the fact that that Mozart wrote his first symphony at age 8 and it was good, you know? Or I mentioned Ein kleiner Nachtmusik at 31. He's practically in the grave. I think he's dead by 35. So, so what I call the Mozart problem, and it came up because I was with my friend at Starbucks in Cambridge, and we were going to go hear Stephen Greenblatt, who's really wrote Will in the World, among other books, a Harvard Shakespearean, and he's good. He's really tight. He's a major scholar. And this guy, John Tobin, came up, and I happen to know that Tobin is a major league scholar at UMass. And I said, you know, we're going to go hear Greenblatt. And Tobin, hilariously, as if on cue, essentially said, he's the Mozart of Shakespeareans. It's really hard for the rest of us to function in his universe. And I have always wanted to write about this phenomenon. I mean, because, of course, as a writer, it's like it's super real. I actually got a lot of negative feedback for quoting from one of my favorite Joan Didion pieces about water in California. She grew up in California. I think she's a beautiful writer.
She is a beautiful writer
on water and a lot of other subjects. So people, Didion, blah blah. I think
she's great.
But the if you're a writer. I mean, it's just an interesting issue.
You know what it is? And I think that anybody, it is, and I tried to find the source of this quote, and I couldn't before I came down here today, but someone wrote something brilliant about the scourge of realizing you have a little bit of talent. And that's what a lot of us realize. You have a little bit of talent, but it's not going to be a lot of talent. It's not going to be genius talent. It's not, and you have to kind of go on plying your trade with that realization. And I think that's...
So how have you dealt with that? I mean, when you compare
it's
column,
depressing.
Alex, to what Earl Morris, for example, has written on the Times website, you have to say, no, I'm serious. Yeah. I mean, you pose the question, so how do you deal with it?
Well, I'm going to answer your question with a question. I mean, people often say to me, you know, what columnists do you admire? Mm-hmm. And I know they want me to say Paul Krugman, whatever her name is, Maureen Dowd. I just know they want me to say these stagers because those are the people they like. And I only have one answer, and it's never someone they've never heard of. I say my favorite. I really wish I could write the way Ron Rosenbaum wrote when he wrote for the New York Observer. Ron Rosenbaum is this close, by the way, to Errol Morris. They are huge Twitter friends,
really?
all over each other. But it was just a moment in time, 6 or 7 years. Ron Rosenbaum was given a lot of space. He's my favorite columnist. But, you know, it's irrelevant. But I don't care if he's better than me or was better than me. I'm doing the best I can.
Who's That's your favorite, right. Marjorie? I think I know, but who's your favorite columnist?
Well, I have a lot.
Well, name a couple.
I was a huge fan, and this is a girl thing, because I bet you would disagree with me.
Are you going to say Anna Quinlan? Because I'm going to leave
no.
the studio.
No,
I was a huge fan of Diane
paper.
White in her heyday when
she
wrote for the Boston Globe. I thought she
brilliant.
Was brilliant.
Well, you and I are dating later because we share this.
Yes, she wrote humor, which is
one
really hard to
ever.
Write. And I'm a huge fan, and this is very common, and you'll probably scoff at me for this too, but I have always been a huge fan of the late, great Nora Ephron. Almost everything she wrote, I adored. And if you haven't read her piece about the woman that was that played in the movies, the Swedish guy that died, you know, the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Oh.
She wrote a very funny
piece. Oh, the piece that she wrote for The New Yorker?
Yes. This woman never smiled. She never smiled. She never smiled because she smiled 350 pages earlier. She couldn't smile again. I mean, Nora Ephron is brilliant. And I mean, I like a lot of women.
Well, God bless you for not saying Anna Quinlan. Nora Ephron is brilliant.
What's the matter with Anna Quinlan?
I don't know. She's just so tedious and so successful.
There's no humor.
There's no humor.
No
and you're
humor.
So right. You know, your guy Mankoff yesterday, I was listening to your show. I mean,
he was
cartoonist
great.
From The New Yorker. He's brilliant.
Humor, man.
Fabulous.
You know.
Well, let's go back. Let's date ourselves even further. Russell Baker of The New York Times.
He was pretty damn good. You know who's really good? I mean, you know, Dave Barry is that's not easy. It's
no,
just
it's
not easy.
Easy
to be funny.
Can I ask who my favorite is?
Okay.
Actually, that's
honestly?
Kinda,
yes.
Errol Morris. Now, the stuff
we all agree with
the
you
Times,
there.
I love.
Tune back in the 28th.
Now, if we can change.
From the corpulent filmmaker.
If we can change. And I hope you don't take this in the wrong way, because you're a pretty honest soul, Alex Beam. You're dressed like crap today. I mean, the shirt
he always
is plaid,
is. He always
the pants,
is.
It just, none of this works.
At least there's no holes.
You're a real fashion plate yourself.
Now, the reason I bring that
it's
up.
It's like you have a bag over your
because,
head or something.
Because Jesus. The reason I bring this up is because you highlighted for us a piece that we both loved that was on Slate.com. Now, this is about a non-fashion trend. Could you describe it to us? Because I've noticed it. I just didn't know there was such a thing.
Well, it's by Simon Doonan, whom I'm pretty sure is the creative director of Barney's of New York.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty certain.
Oh, that makes it even better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when he says we in that piece, he's talking about a very sophisticated male dressing fraternity. And refresh my memory. Does he call this style numcore?
Normcore.
Excuse me.
N-O-R-M-C-O-R-E, a term that I had never heard before.
Me neither. Normcore. But what struck me about this piece, hilariously, was he was actually describing me. He's sort of describing the trend of the past 15 or 20 years among men who don't perceive themselves as fashionable to retreat. I mean, the images he uses are just unbelievable, like a Belgian guidance counselor. But basically, it's the retreat to Dockers. He doesn't use those words, but that's the way I sort of see it. He says it sort of started with J. Press and Brooks,
yes.
Which I agree with. They were like sort of commercially successful about 15 years ago. That I like, you know, preppy has never been good, handsome, stylish. It's always been plaid shirts, freaking chinos, Weegians. Are you bleeping kidding me?
Let me read you one great line from this. Ugh. The normcore look, this is written by Simon Doonan, who Alex believes is the is a big shot at Barney's, which is the clothing store in New York City for men. The normcore look is a knowing piss take of the heterosexual male's desperate desire to be sartorially unremarkable. Normcore is not brave or butch or swaggery. Normcore is about dressing like a mild-mannered mental patient or a bewildered Icelandic exchange student circa 1984, which is just, I mean, that's it proud as good as it.
You know, the reason that so resonated with me is that there was an editor at the Boston Globe named Andy Zellman who once...
Oh, sure, yeah.
She's a very stylish woman, by the way.
Very stylish.
Who once met me in the corner and looked me up and down, and she said, "Alex, that homeless look just isn't working for you." But let's give Doonan his what a wonderful piece, because it's of course it's a lot of complicated things. It's men kind of fearful of being gay. There's an element of that.
Yeah.
Like, oh, if I dress well, people will perceive me as this or that.
But you know what's funny? I said this to Jim before the show. If you go overseas, which I did to visit one of my kids last year and the year before that, because they both did the junior year abroad thing. It's hard to tell who the American women are because they can sort of assimilate a little bit. But American men just stick out like sore thumbs.
True.
I mean, they've
totally
got the, whether it's jeans or whether it's the sweatshirts or whether it's the khaki pants that are getting dressed up. Yes. The baseball cap. Yeah, they just look so American. It's just an unusual thing. And by the way, our crack production team here, Stieg Larsson, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah.
If you have not read Nora Ephron's piece about the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it is a riot.
It is very funny. But you need to pull the tail end of your observation, because if you go, say, to Western Europe, the men and women appear very stylish, and it's not just rich men. That's the weird
thing. That is exactly correct, particularly in places like Italy, and it's totally true.
France, Italy.
But the men look much more feminine. They don't look, and they're slighter
They're slender.
They're slender, and I don't mean feminine in like they're wearing girlish clothes. There's just something more. The American men just look.
But they're willing to take more chances, which is the last thing I want to ask you about this. You do dress in a certain way. I mean, you do.
I'm trying to upgrade a little
bit.
But in
all seriousness, fetching, Jim. What are
you
talking
about? I can't even describe that.
In Missouri. I got this in Missouri. Mormon.
Are you not at the place, and this is a serious question, even though you're not going to take it as such, are you not at the place where if on a particular day you decide, I really want to dress up today, you probably wouldn't want to go out and be seen that way because people would note that Alex Beam is dressed up today because of how he ordinarily looks. Do you understand my point?
I sort of do, but...
Do you ever have that in your consciousness, or am I missing...
I distinguish between dressing like a grown-up and dressing the way... But I have... I don't know, about 6 years ago, I realized that I had to start... sometimes attending grown-up events and like behaving like a grown-up.
You don't look like this at a grown-up event.
I'm here with my pals.
Okay, fine.
Do you still use a backpack to carry your stuff in?
Ooh, that's...
Because that's a very I refuse to grow up kind of thing for men to do.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
You
know, the answer is yes, obviously.
No, but you know what's even worse? That's why I was bugging you for the free tote bag. I now carry those like a... bread and circus type totes.
Yes,
I'm the idiot with the tote, which to me also feels the whole men bag. It's just
Jim has one. You have a man purse.
Maybe I do. Now, in any case, Alex, you started a tradition that's become a huge
messenger
part of our
bags,
show.
Obviously, that's
excuse me.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. We're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah,
okay.
We are.
Okay.
He bicycled here.
Three or four
Cambridge.
Weeks ago, you started something that's become a critical part of our show. It's the 45-second explainer of the complex and convoluted. Now, I asked listeners to send in something they'd like you to explain, and we've had very few responses. One you thanked a couple of weeks ago, and I'll read it again because you've chosen one of his choices.
Because I assume that's the only response we've had?
Or? May have been. I'm not sure. Now, this was sent by Jack Murphy, and we have a timer. It's starting in a minute. He says, "Dear Jim, I'm an avid listener of your show and a big fan of your weekly guest, the infallible Alex Beam. For his next appearance, I would like Beam to distill the essence of one of the following topics, and Alex has chosen one of these. The one he did not choose, which I hope you do in the future, the physics of sandcastles. The second one, which Alex has chosen, and we're going to get the clock ready, and we're going to time you, the producers are. The sovereignty status, a lot of people are interested in this, in British graves in Concord 3, the stern countenance of Eastern Europeans, whatever that means. Now, do you understand what he wanted you to do?
I do, in
okay,
fact.
Okay, fine.
I do,
okay,
yeah.
Now, we are going to start a clock. We ready to do this, producers, colleagues? On the count of three, the 45 seconds will start. Alex will explain the sovereignty status of British graves in Concord 3, starting Now, go ahead.
Okay, but I'm actually not going to run fast at the mouth because this is an interesting subject I've actually taken the time to bone up on. Murphy.
42 seconds. Go ahead.
Oh, Jesus, man.
Ignore him. Ignore him,
Alex. Like
go
cutting,
ahead.
We're in Errol Morris's studio cutting Donald Rumsfeld. Yeah. It's an interesting issue. Graves in foreign countries, do they constitute sovereign ground or sovereign territory? The beautiful Rupert Brooke poem, you know, in some corner of a foreign land, there will be a place that is forever England. He, in fact, died in France. He was saying that where he died, his grave in France should be forever England. Okay. No, those graves in Concord are not British sovereign ground. However, interestingly, there are two locations in the United States that are British sovereign ground, where ground has been ceded to the United Kingdom. One is unbelievable. Captain James Cook was killed on a Hawaiian island, and Captain James Cook's grave belongs to the United Kingdom. It is 18 square feet.
That's pretty good.
It belongs to UK. I got one more example, even if I'm over. In Ocracoke on the Outer Banks, there are two small cemeteries that have a few British graves. Those are under the protection of the National Park Service, but they've been deeded to the United Kingdom because these are British seamen who died in it was called Torpedo Junction off of Cape Hatteras during World War II. Before we broke the code, the U-boats were just slaughtering American shipping, and 21 British ships came to form a screen to try to help us ward off the U-boats. And several British seamen died.
Let me just say, even though that took a minute and 24
impressive.
Seconds, that was fabulous.
Well,
that really
you.
Was fabulous.
It's an interesting question.
Jack, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
thank
next
you
week,
much,
are you
Jack.
Doing the physics of sandcastles? Is that what you're
I don't
doing?
Know. Can I say what I want to talk about next week?
Sure. Go ahead. Yeah, go
okay.
Ahead.
I want to talk about my favorite subject at incredible length. I want to talk about Tenebrae, which falls next Thursday, the Christian Festival of Darkness. I've written a column about it. I'll send it to you.
Great.
Yeah,
I'm
it's
psyched.
Really it's my favorite day of the entire year.
Christian
I
Festival
say,
of what?
I
darkness.
Say,
darkness.
I want to
yeah.
say one more thing since this is my show, or at least half of it. I should also mention, as long as I was plugging Nora Ephron, a few words about breasts. You can Google it. It is absolutely hysterical. And Joan Didion's goodbye to all that about leaving New York City.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Just two little things.
Well, Joan Didion's just a big talent, let's face it.
Slouching Towards Bethlehem, one of the best things I ever read in my whole life.
Alex, you look fabulous today.
She's
great to see you.
Okay.
Thank you,
Jim.
So
I like your shirt.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll be back or not.
Alex Beam, if you haven't read his column in the Boston Globe today, you've got to read it. It is absolutely brutal, but I loved it. He's the author of numerous books as well, and they should remain unnamed until further notice. Alex, it's always great to talk to you. Up next, if you do not like exercising, could your genetic makeup exempt you from your sedentary ways? Are we born to run or not? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.